Hi there, Jonathan here. The following talk is offered freely to ensure that no one is ever denied access to these practices and to these teachings. If you feel inspired to make a donation to support this offering, you can go to my website where you can also sign up for a monthly newsletter designed to support you in your practice. That's at www.jonathanfaust.com. Thank you and enjoy. So you may be familiar with Maslow's hierarchy of needs. Someone sent me a little cartoon here with an updated version of basic human needs. At the top of the pyramid is self-actualization, you know, self-realization. Below that is healthy esteem, confidence, achievement in the world. Below that is social needs, you know, family, intimacy, friendship. Below that in the pyramid is safety and security. And below that is physiological needs, you know, survival, air, shelter, water, and food. This new pyramid has yet another fundamental universal human need that really underscores them all, Wi-Fi. So I'm back from another week-long retreat. We had 85 people in silence this week, a lot of churning and burning, and a lot of really, really wonderful insights and many, many different shared experiences. And just as in this 30-minute meditation, you may have felt a lot of waves, maybe some sleepiness or restlessness, and maybe a little bit of settling. You know, one of the great analogies is like you take a glass of muddy water and you let it sit long enough and the sediment starts to clear. You might feel a little bit clearer just in that 30 minutes. You can imagine what that might be like over 7 days, all in silence of sitting and walking and sitting and walking and so forth. The process that we engage in here, the contemporary nomenclature is mindfulness. And that's the topic for this talk. My personal peeve with the current popular name for this practice of mindfulness. And I'll explain a little bit why I have some problems with it in the next 30 minutes, 35 minutes. One is how there's no mind in mindfulness. That's kind of confusing. And there's no heart in mindfulness. And we'll talk a little bit about, well, what really is it? And how do we actually practice kind of mindfulness in its purest form? Because there are many different interpretations of what it is. Sometimes it's called watching the movement of the mind, which it certainly is, where we're cultivating some capacity for self-observation. So there's oftentimes a sense that, well, it's really just watching your mind, you know, taking a backseat and watching your mind, which is true. There is something in Pali, the language of the Buddha, the word is called papancha, and it's translated as the proliferation. So you'll start with one thought, and it just proliferates and has its own life form until at some point you realize you're lost in thought. So I shared on the retreat a thought process that I went through in one of my talks. In the main retreat center, the HVAC, you know, the heating, cooling, it was pretty loud. And it was also a little bit manic. It would kind of move from really hot to really cold, and that was all part of our shared experience. And for many, many years, it's been like that as we've been at the retreat center. So in one of the early morning sits of the 6:45 sit, my thought process went something like this. Man, that HVAC system is really loud. is that a bad bearing or something? How many times have we had to deal with this? It's either roasting hot or freezing cold, and, well, now I'm hot. Should I take off my sweater? You know, I like this sweater. This is really one of the best gifts I've ever gotten. I've never owned a cashmere sweater before. What is a cashmere sweater? Oh, but if I take it off, then I'll get cold, and I hate being cold. Why did I spend 5 years in Wisconsin and 24 years in Western Massachusetts? That's crazy. Why do I always do things that are contrary to what I really want? I just go with the flow. I'm always trying to accommodate other people. I'm just not self-directed enough. Wait, what am I doing? Oh, yeah. Right, the breath. Man, that HVAC system is loud. Is that a bad bearing or something? How many times have we had to deal with this? Can anyone relate? One of the things we talk about in meditation practice, and particularly when you're on a long retreat, and there's nothing else to do but watch your mind, is to identify your top 10. The top 10 stories that just keep coming around and around and around. And it can be quite valuable to see that. Because inevitably, the more you slow down, the more you'll notice. And you will notice the movement of your mind. You'll notice the habitual ways your mind just goes down, just in a very conditioned way, just goes down certain channels. And it can even be possible to slow down enough in meditation where you might notice yourself off on some anger revenge fantasy. And then you can slow it down and say, you can just say, wait a minute, what was I thinking before that? And in that slowing down, you can begin to see how sometimes thoughts are interrelated and how they proliferate in a really, really big way. Be very, very helpful. But the thing is, the practice is not about the mind. It's more about awareness of the mind. So then I thought, well, if it's not mindfulness, is it awarenessfulness? Would that be what we could call it? I find myself, and I certainly use this phrase a lot, I like to think of what we're practicing as non-judging awareness. For me, that's a much closer sense of really what you're engaging to in the practice. Or maybe even non-present moment non-judging awareness. And when you kind of try that one on, it kind of gives you it points toward an experience. What it means to be in the present moment without judgment. It opens something up inside a little bit, I find. So there's no mind in mindfulness, but we're aware of the mind. But we're also aware of a lot more than the mind. We're aware of just the energetic experience of being alive in a body. We're also aware of the feeling tone of all those sensations. We're aware of the pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. All of that is also part of the practice. And there's something else that's missing in the word mindfulness, which I think really doesn't do the practice justice, and that is there's no heart in the word mindfulness. And that kind of suggests a very kind of impartial view of your experience, to just be aware of the mind. You may have seen a little skit that Bob Newhart did many, many years ago, where he played the role of this sort of famous therapist, and he charged like $200 a session, and the session was only 5 minutes. And if you went beyond 5 minutes, it would be another $200. So you've seen that one. It's a really great skit. And so someone decides they're going to go for this 5-minute $200 session. And she starts off on a story like, you know, my father, I just don't, you know, I just find I'm getting really, really angry with my father. It just sort of erupts and there's really nothing I can do about it. And so she tells her story, and then Bob Newhart says, stop doing that. That's the end of the session. And in some ways, we can look through that lens, through that filter of just stop it. But really, what we're seeing into in the practice is cause and effect. We're really seeing into the nature of karma. As you sow, so shall you reap. This fundamental element of life. So they're really two wings that are really important, and they have to be in balance. It's the two wings of the bird that allows it to fly. The first is penetrating clear insight, seeing clearly. That's the wing of wisdom. So what's the truth about this? Burn off my embellishment, my preference, my version of the story. What is actually true? And when you practice, eventually you begin to see more clearly. You begin to see through the delusion of the mind. You begin to see what you're believing that isn't true and what you aren't believing that actually is true. And that is so important. But there's another element, which is really developing how you hold your experience. The whole realm of compassion. The capacity to be with the hurt, the pain, the disappointment, the fear, the anxiety. It's one thing to see it. It's another to hold it in a way that allows you to let it go. Compassion has been described as the lubrication that allows you to let go. It's not until you can truly see how deeply painful something may be to really get to the ouch, to see that clearly, and then to meet that with empathy or compassion or kindness, then there's a possibility of truly letting it go. One of the ridiculous gifts that I have is to be able to do what I do here and to be part of these retreats and to have done this for so many decades. When I'm on retreat, I'm offering talks, and we have different meditations, guided meditations and instructions. But much of what I do is to meet with people about their practice. So either there are small groups that meet a few times where each person shares for, you know, 5 or so minutes about what they're noticing. But then when you do a longer retreat, you have an interview with a teacher. It's just 15 minutes. But it's an opportunity just to kind of sit and describe what you're working with. And it might be a difficulty. It might be something really non-ordinary that you'd like some insight. It might be a question about the practice. And I will have maybe 12 of those 15-minute interviews throughout a morning. And it's just 15 minutes of total intensity, and then the next person comes in, and I never know what the next person will be holding as they walk in. You know, it might be very, very deep despair and grieving. It might be a sense of exhilaration. It might be them just wanting to tell me how great they're doing. It might be, it can be anything at all. So it's a very open space that I need to hold to be as present as I can be for each person. And it's fascinating to see how when people come in and they're struggling, I really have to draw on both of these wings to really see, to help someone see clearly what their experience is and to perceive clearly what their experience is, and then to explore, is there some way to access some form of loving presence that can hold that experience? There's a one person who shared how she was really getting in contact with just how deeply dysfunctional her family was, and a lot of neglect and shame and abuse. And she realized that those patterns were showing up with her kids. As much as she was horrified by that behavior, under times of stress, it would just come out. And as she was dealing with that, I could see very clearly through that lens of pure wisdom, pure conditioning. Well, this is the conditioning that you grew up in, and now that conditioning is playing out in how you're treating your children. But also seeing it through the lens of compassion, just sensing the suffering of her parents, the suffering that she was incurring, the suffering that she was passing on. We tend to hold ourselves through that lens of constant judgment. But as we explored, both seeing very, very clearly this pattern of abuse that she recognized was, it wasn't just her parents, it was her grandparents. You know, she realized, I saw this pattern in my grandparents, and how far back does that chain go? So in her practice, she could see very, very clearly cause and effect. This was her karmic inheritance. But it was only when she could really feel the impact of what she felt as a kid, and then to really feel the impact of what was happening with her kids, only when she could really feel that was she able to sense it in a way where it might shift. There have been a number of times in this exploration of, again, seeing clearly, but also opening to the really deep, compassionate holding of it, where someone, particularly in a pattern like that, like a familiar intergenerational pattern, where someone will suddenly stop and then say, "This ends with me. I will not hand this on to the next generation. This is not going on to my kids." Those are the moments that are really quite profound. And it really calls for a willingness to move into those compassion realms, to move into the heart space. Whenever that's out of balance, when you're just looking through the wing of through the lens of wisdom, it's very cold. Oh, cause and effect. This happened, so that happened. If you look solely through the lens of just pure compassion with no wisdom, there's really never any profound shift, because you never get to the lesson that you really need to get in your own practice. So I thought I might lead just a brief little reflection on this that might be interesting. If you like, you might close your eyes and you might bring into mind someone in your life who is struggling, someone you know who may be going through a difficult time. And you might just take a moment to imagine them, just visualize them. And you might just over the next few moments to look through the lens of wisdom, to look at cause and effect. What are the causes and conditions that are behind this struggle? And then you might bring in this lens of of sensing through the heart. What do you imagine this person is feeling? What are they wanting or needing that's not happening? And you might, in your own way, take this time to wish them well. And through this lens of compassion, to offer your blessings. And you might reflect, what are the lessons here for this person to learn? So you might deepen the breath. And if you like, you can open the eyes or feel free to remain with them closed. So this practice includes noticing the mind. It's also about noticing the heart, exploring this balance of both wisdom and compassion. And it's also about turning our attention toward what's between us and feeling free. When you practice meditation, just as in life, inevitably you will hit major difficulties, physical pain, emotional turmoil, mental challenges. And the practice is, rather than trying to nuke it or bury it or try not to think about it, or maybe to exaggerate it or play it out, to actually turn toward it, to get curious about it, to look clearly, to see clearly, and also to explore how to be with it. So, training of the heart is actually a good solid 50% of the practice. Training your capacity to hold your experience. So then, if the practice includes awareness of mind and feeling and sensation and heart, how do we practice it? And there's a story from Joseph Goldstein that I really love. It kind of points to how subtle it gets. He's talking about on a retreat where he could feel like everything was really open, but he was feeling kind of a block in his neck. And he went to see his teacher for his interview. And he reported that, you know, like everything's feeling really, really open except for this block in my neck. But he said, but I'm being mindful of it. I'm holding it in mindfulness. And the teacher said, you know, just by calling it a block, you're saying, I don't want this and I want something else. And then Joseph said he realized that he was observing it, but he didn't realize that he was observing it through a filter. And the filter was judgment. And so this becomes a really interesting, very subtle part of the practice, is it's not just observing, but being aware of the filter through which you are observing. And we can ask ourselves in meditation, well, what is the attitude in my mind right now? Because you're observing, but you may be viewing through a lens of wanting, or through a lens of judgment, or through a lens of worry. And when you can really slow down in your practice and notice, there is almost in every moment some form of a filter. I don't like this. I want this. So just a very brief little reflection again. If you like, you can close your eyes. So in this moment of practice, what is the phenomena that is most present for you? And what is the attitude in your mind? And you may find that sometimes just by asking, what is the attitude in your mind? That question can actually bring about a release. So again, if you like, you can deepen the breath and you can let your eyes open. If you're interested, Joseph Goldstein has a book on mindfulness, which is an adaptation of 45 talks he gave on Anapanasati, the teachings, the core teachings of mindfulness. And it's remarkable in that it's so simple and at the same time has so much richness and complexity to it. But he talks about how we might think of mindfulness as, number one, just living in the present. And that's true. It is about living in the present. But there's more to it than just being present. He gives the example of if you see a black lab, you know, a little black lab puppy, it's very much in the present moment. But it may not be mindful. So, there's another quality of where you're observing, but you know you're observing something. And that's the quality that we're looking at here. But it's also recognizing that when you are observing through a filter, you can be in the moment and observe, but you can observe through fear, you can observe through desire, you can observe through the filter of anger. Recognizing the filter is where the freedom is. That makes sense. There's a great saying that says, when a pickpocket sees a saint, all he sees are the pockets. So when I find when I'm looking through that filter of fear, all I'm seeing is danger. When I'm looking through a filter of anger, all I'm seeing is avoiding domination or trying to dominate. So this sort of points toward, again, back to this sense of non-judging observation. Can you observe without judgment? So this is where the liberation is. This is where the freedom is. That in any given moment, you can be present, you can be in anger, and as soon as you recognize you're viewing through that filter of anger, it shifts. Sometimes immediately, sometimes not quite so fast. It's the difference between being angry and being with your anger. When you're with your anger as the observer, that's when you open the possibility for insight. That's when you can take the step back and ask yourself, wait a minute, what am I believing right here? Or what am I needing that's not happening? Or what is that person needing that's not happening? And suddenly, there are possibilities where they didn't exist before. And this is part of what we can see in your brain when you meditate. When you're hooked up to functional MRIs, that there are certain parts of your brain that get flooded with energy. A lot of the evolutionary development of the brain is in the prefrontal cortex, which is the capacity to be aware of self and be aware of other. It's the self-regulating element of your brain where your mind starts freaking out and the prefrontal cortex goes, well, wait a minute. It's not that bad. You're going to be okay. You've gone through this before. Then you calm, the nervous system calms. That's why Robert Thurman calls meditation an evolutionary sport. You know, you're evolving your brain when you engage into this practice. So the practice of stepping back is so powerful. It's a great story from Adyashanti, one of my favorite teachers, who was given a question to contemplate in meditation in his particular tradition in Zen. So he was contemplating this question. And then he had a moment, a big shift. And he went back to his teacher and he said, "I'm not so sure anymore that it's about contemplating the question you gave me. But there's something here about contemplating who it is that's asking the question." Zen teacher had a big smile on her face. And that's kind of what happens when you can step back. I was once, many, many years ago, about to lead a meditation retreat, and I was paired up with another teacher who I didn't know that well, but had a reputation of being someone difficult to work with. And I was really dreading the experience, because I, you know, wanted to deliver an experience that was spacious and open and non-judging, and I didn't want to be in a conflict or a power struggle with my co-leader. So as I got closer to this meeting, I realized that I was completely shut down. I was, you know, very, very self-protective. And in that practice of just calming and coming back in the presence, becoming more aware of what I was really feeling on the inside and what I was believing. You know, I was believing it was going to be a conflict. You know, I was aware that I was really needing for us to have a good connection. It suddenly occurred to me that he might have needs too. And so as I just continued to sit, I became more aware of, well, you know, he probably needs to feel connected. And he probably needs to feel like we're a really strong team. And something in that practice, I wasn't doing anything other than just relaxing, paying attention to what was there, being curious about it. And the shift began to occur. So I became more aware of myself. I became more aware of the other. And that created a very, very powerful shift. So then the question is, what are some of the techniques that you can use to help you to get that stepping back, where you can be the observer of not just what's happening, but be aware of the filter through which you're perceiving? So I thought we just have a little bit of time left. I might leave just one more little meditation. So again, you might close your eyes and feel the breath. There is a two-part definition of meditation that I find helpful. The first element is to be aware of what is happening as it's happening. And as you relax and feel, how intimately can you feel this breath on the inside? Can you be aware of the sounds, the vibrations? There's one technique that some people find helpful in mindfulness, something you can use occasionally, is called labeling or noting. And that is when you notice the mind thinking, to just label it thinking. If you're aware of a strong sensation, you label that as feeling. Just another thing you might practice for a minute or two is if you notice a little more detail in the thoughts, you might notice that thoughts fall into categories. There is wanting, aversion, worry, doubt, criticism. And can you sense in your own way that if you are feeling restless, awareness is not restless. It is the awareness of restlessness. If you're feeling sad, awareness is not sad, but it is aware of sadness. Just one more little pointing out instruction, then I'll read a little poem and then we'll close. There is a very interesting balance in the practice of meditation. One is a deep, deep relaxation and allowing. And you might sense now, is there anything that could soften or relax or let go? The second is this quality of alertness, to be aware of everything that is happening and to sense that stepping back, to be aware even of the filter through which you are perceiving, the filter of grasping, the filter of pushing away. Following is a little reading about the artist Hokusai. Hokusai says, look carefully. He says, pay attention, notice. He says, keep looking, stay curious. He says, there is no end to seeing. He says everything is alive, shells, buildings, people, fish, mountains, trees. Everything has its own life. Everything lives inside you. He says it matters that you care. It matters that you feel. It matters that you notice. It matters that life lives through you. Look and feel. Let life take you by the hand. Let life live through you. And gently, when you're ready, you can deepen the breath. And when you're ready, you can open your eyes. So whether you call it mindfulness or awarefulness or heartfulness or non-judging awareness. This really is a practice that is not only about increasing your capacity for happiness and joy. It really is a practice that points toward freedom. What it means to live more and more intimately in that place of non-judgment. To be aware and to be without judgment is a true experience of freedom.